It's a celebration here in the studio because the CyberWork with InfoSec podcast is a winner. Thanks to the Cybersecurity Excellence Awards for awarding us a Best Cybersecurity Podcast gold medal in our category. Yeah. We're celebrating, but we're giving all of you the gift. We're once again giving away a free month of our InfoSec Skills platform, which features targeted learning modules, cloud-hosted cyber ranges, hands-on projects, certification practice exams, and skills assessments. To take advantage of this special offer for CyberWork listeners, head over to infosecinstitute.com/skills or click the link in the description below. Sign up for an individual subscription as you normally would. Then, in the coupon box, type the word CyberWork, CYBERWORK, no spaces, no capital letters, and just like magic, you can claim your free month. Thank you once again for listening to and watching our podcast. We appreciate each and every one of you coming back each week. So enough of that, let's begin the episode. Welcome to this week's episode of the CyberWork with InfoSec podcast. Each week, I sit down with a different industry thought leader, and we discuss the latest cybersecurity trends, how those trends are affecting the work of InfoSec professionals, while offering tips for those trying to break in or move up the ladder in the cybersecurity industry. Carl Sharman is vice president with Beecher Madden, a cybersecurity staffing and recruiting firm based out of London. We talk a lot about cybersecurity tips, career tips here. This is called cyber work after all, but it's not every day that we get to talk to someone who actually helps put people into their dream positions. So we're going to talk about ways that security departments can find the right people for their positions, how professionals can find places to work, and how hiring and career movement is happening in the age of shelter in place. Carl Sharman is a former head of recruitment in football, soccer, that assisted in selling £1 million worth of talent for a variety of clubs. Since switching to cybersecurity recruitment in 2017, Carl is now the North American practice leader for prominent cybersecurity recruitment company, Beecher Madden. With 10 years of recruitment experience, he supports organizations in their help to identify, acquire, and retain talent in the cybersecurity and risk management sector across North America. He consults the industry on career paths, salary benchmarking, talent pools, and recruitment and retaining strategies. Carl was featured in the top 1% of search and staffing professionals globally by LinkedIn, and Beecher Madden won Security Recruitment Company of the Year for 2019. Carl, thank you so much for joining us today on CyberWork.
No, thank you for having me. It's a real pleasure.
So I want to talk about your background a little bit. That's a great bio. So you moved over to cybersecurity recruiting specifically around 2017, and before that you were involved with football or, soccer for us Yanks. When did you first get interested in computers and tech? Was this something that you were interested in, when you were younger, or did this come later in life or just with this particular job change?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So I think when growing up, animals and sport and, they were sort of my two things growing up. I did a lot of soccer. I am based in America, so I have to say soccer now, and I did a lot of horseback riding and stuff like that growing up as well. So they were like my two obsessions. And my uncle introduced me to a computer. He's a aircraft engineer, and he was very technical in that respect and introduced me to computers at a very young age. Okay. And got me into that sort of, gaming world and a lot of different other areas. But it wasn't really till I came out of university where I did football and business studies at university. And I only knew computing for the internet, Microsoft Word, Excel as a normal worker. But when I got into the soccer industry, it was very data driven, database heavy, a lot of analysis from that respect. So I had to learn a lot of technology that I hadn't. But because I've been exposed to that, it allowed me to accelerate my career and allowed me to go up the ladder a lot quicker, because when I entered the soccer industry, they were looking for people that had that type of skill set, who were quick learners, adaptable with technology, because so much technology was entering the market. This was in sort of 2013. 2013-2014, and we had, you know, all these statistical data-driven, like I said, technologies entering the market. And a lot of the, you know, no disrespect, but a lot of the older guard who used a notepad to do scouting suddenly had to adapt their methods, but were a lot slower and stuff like that, and it allowed me to accelerate. So that was my real exposure into technology. When you ask about cybersecurity, that's very different. I think you're aware of like generic terms, being a generic person, you know, like hacking or phishing, you know, them types of things. And you're very aware of, I suppose, the word fraud or scam is a lot more common than that for a normal person. And I think once you start to even read a little bit of the content, you suddenly start getting a little bit obsessed. It's like them, it's like their murder stories that you get on Netflix, and you watch one and then you, you want to watch more. And, and it became like that with cybersecurity. It became like another, I won't go as far as an obsession, but there's some great people out there that put some great content out there. You know, whether it's podcasts, written content, a variety of different methods. Right. And I just started reading about it. And then in 2017, I had a lot of some failures, some deliberate choices, I suppose, in the soccer industry. And I opted to team up with a soccer agent who had started his own recruitment company, and he started in technology, and they were making a lot of their money through developers and, you know, placing developers, building architecture teams for companies, doing a lot of transformation work. And one area that he hadn't touched was cybersecurity. So I saw, I approached him, and him and his other co-founders interviewed me to head up that space for them. And that's how it really started. And I sort of used my recruitment and talent acquisition skills and just had been learning and reading about cybersecurity. And it was a huge learning curve talking to people like CISOs, you know, CIOs. About what they do.
For me too. I'm learning on the fly as well here, right with you.
Well, I mean, firstly, what you do is a great way of learning. Because all I did was ask a lot of questions and listened, and that was really exactly my acceleration. But it works. It works. And that's my recommendation to anyone who wants to get into the industry and learn, is just ask. Like, ask as many questions. People want to give you that time, especially in the US. You know, the UK culture is slightly different, and that's where I've come from. You know, you will find people that want to learn, but not everyone wants to give you that helping hand. And that's just the British culture, unfortunately. But in the US, I found that once I entered this market in early 2018, it was just over two and a half years ago now. It was totally different. Everyone wanted to have that conversation. And I have a number of mentors who are CISOs in the US now, who, if I need to understand about certain aspects of, you know, a NIST framework or certain aspects about this technology to help me better answer questions for my clients, I'm now able to do that because of the help I had. And that was really what accelerated my knowledge in the market, was just asking questions.
Okay. So I guess we're here today to talk about, you know, hiring strategies in the cybersecurity industry. So I'd like to start with a topic that's been very curious to us here at InfoSec. We've had some mixed messages regarding hiring practices in cybersecurity. Are you finding that organizations are emphasizing the need for traditional educational credentials like a BA or a BS when searching for candidates?
I feel like this question's come up a lot lately, like a lot from organizations, a lot in interviews. A lot of people have contacted me about this. What are we seeing? And I must say, and I don't have the official stats on it, but I imagine, looking through our job descriptions since the start of the year, 95% will still include a bachelor's degree. And there's a real issue in that, because, as you know, and as many people know that will be listening and watching this, not everyone has a degree. You know, I think there's, you know, firstly, there's a great group out there called Aspen Cybersecurity, who are trying to change the initiative with this, like we are. You know, we spend a lot of time, probably 60 to 70% of my time is spent educating clients on what they should look for, how job descriptions should be. And poor job descriptions are leading to this myth of a skills gap. And I'm sure we're going to come onto that as well in a little while. But going back to your point about bachelor's degree, so many companies ask for this, especially large organizations. And normally it comes down to company policy.
Yeah.
So normally it's done because the finance team has to have this, or the sales team has to have this. But in cybersecurity, we're creating our own skills gap, which is only created by ourselves,
yes,
that is being generated by people making poor job descriptions. And I think that's, you know, that's what allows it to be exciting for us, and where it creates an opportunity for us, because it creates that education path for organizations. And I know it's hard because the security team aren't in control of all these processes, aren't in control if there needs to be a bachelor's degree, but there are some companies that will get better talent by just opening this market up. And I think, like, I think with that, I think we need to get over this bias. I think we have this old school bias that university degrees equal being intelligent. And I think that's totally wrong. And I think a lot of people rely on that. A lot of organizations rely on that as a safety buffer, and to say, if this person fails, oh, he had all the credentials, had all the certifications, he must have just been the wrong fit. And I think that's a total wrong way of looking at it. I think we need to take more risks. I think we need to take more chances on people. And my push to my clients is very much, why don't we measure on culture fit? You know, why don't we look at them avenues and start to look down them routes, rather than focus so much on certifications and degrees? Because certification degrees, all they do is they're a tick box exercise in certain cases. And, you know, I'm one to talk, I'm currently on my master's degree. So, you know, I'm not exactly living by my own standards.
You're not anti, you know, education anyway. It's just, it's a specific sort of barrier to entry that might not be necessary there.
Exactly right. And I've had very, very excellent candidates that are rejected in the process because they don't have a degree. And there's even companies that will reject them if they don't finish the degrees or the certifications before they can accept the job. I mean, it's just, it's insane to me. It's a barrier that we're putting in place that we don't need to. And like I said, I think it's very much a bias. I think it's very much to protect people. And cybersecurity, you know, and this is sometimes the problem with HR generalists in certain cases, is they base cybersecurity on every other market in that organization. As we know, cybersecurity is very complex. It's a very different market. You know, sometimes you need to break down them barriers of the exactly same salaries for audit as it is for cybersecurity, or the exact same salaries for, you know, the finance team as it is for cybersecurity. But we also need to do the same with job descriptions. And degrees is a huge part of that. And like I said, there's a number of groups that are trying to improve this. But me personally, I'd rather go to an organization that wasn't making that and putting barriers in my place, because if that's the type of red tape that they're putting in place, that could be the red tape that they're, that could be a sign of the red tape they could put in other places when trying to maneuver.
Right. So yeah, I asked that question specifically because there's a very interesting sort of friction going around right now. Like, I talk to a lot of, you know, CISOs, CEOs, even CEOs of their own companies and so forth, who will say, you know, as long as you have the ability to prove, you know, your work, lack of degree doesn't matter. But, you know, we're still hearing these stories, like you said, where, you know, people without degrees aren't even getting sort of in the door. So there seems to be this sort of disconnect between HR or the hiring manager, you know, tailoring these job descriptions, looking for these unicorn candidates. But at the same time, like, you know, on the other side of the barrier, there's the people who would actually work with this person saying, I don't need any of that stuff, you know? So, it's not even just that we're sort of like trying to turn the hearts and minds of these companies. It's that we're trying to get them to sort of even sort of connect together within their own company, between the sort of what IT security departments need and what HR is trying to give them. So, you know, what do we do? What do we do about this friction?
Well, that's the hardest part. You know, if you go into any organization, there are a number of rifts, friction, as you say, that's a good way of describing it. And I think often it is between HR and the hiring managers, you know, and sometimes we get involved in that because we get stuck in the middle. You know, we're here trying to place a candidate, and that's all our aim is. Our aim is to solve the CISO's pain. That's the way we look at it. So, you know, we're 100% focused on that. And sometimes HR or other leaders get involved and block that because they have their own agenda. And that's, you know, for anything that we're looking to do, the number one skill that we need is influence. And the number one skill that a CISO needs currently is influence. How much influence can you get over your board, over your C-suite, over your HR? And we're in exactly the same position. We're trying to influence as many people to convince them that our candidate is the one that they need for this position.
I'm imagining this is the sort of thing that, you know, eventually people will get the point, but by then it'll be too late. So like, are there things that we can sort of be doing in the meantime to sort of,
yeah,
as you say, be swaying the C-suite and be, you know, swaying HR and stuff?
For me, it's data. It's being evidence, yeah, you know, data led. And what I right. mean is not just chucking data for the sake of chucking data. It's actually quality, high quality data. And for me, that's evidence. That's the evidence. If it's taking too long to fill a position, and what I mean like that is anything over, I suppose 8 to 12 weeks, yeah, is way too long to fill. Now I get it. Companies might have real long processes, and we can come onto that. Company processes. And we might lose candidates through that process. I totally understand right. that. And that's why companies sometimes partner with us to try and manage them candidates through the process. However, there are certain things we can do. And one of them is what we say to our clients is, what's the three things you cannot live without on this job description? Eliminate the rest. What's the three things you can't live without? Yes. Because you start to make hiring managers and HR directors or whoever it is in the talent acquisition process really consider what's a priority. And prioritizing is probably what the humans are worst at by far, because we just want to find this perfect person.
You want everything.
Yeah, exactly. And there isn't that perfect person out there. And we rule out very, very good candidates because they haven't got A to Z, while really we just need A, B, and C. That's all we need. And the rest of it is culture fit. And that should be 30% should be the three things. 70% should be culture fit. Because if you've got someone who wants to learn, who's ambitious, who's driven, who's going to do their absolute all for the loyalty of the person or the brand, depending on where their loyalty sits, and often it's the person, often it will be the CISO or their hiring manager, that goes a lot further than having certifications, a degree, 100 things that needs to be happening. And what we find, our data has always told us, when we're looking at diversity recruitment, which is something that we spend a lot of time on, a lot of candidates don't apply for that job because the job description is too long. And we find that neurodiverse and often women rule themselves out when they get two things that they haven't got, two or more things that they haven't got on that job description, they rule themselves out. So you could be ruling out 30 to 40% of your talent pool solely through making job descriptions too complex, too difficult to adhere to, or too long, which can be quite boring for people. If you look at our website or the way we do job descriptions, we have three things that you need to that you will be doing on your day job, and three things that you need to have to be qualified for that position. And that's how we qualify people. And that's what we try to tell our clients. And unfortunately, like you said, there's a friction there because often it's company policy. So I think the CISO needs to be a little bit more open when applicants are coming through and actually bypass HR and go, right, these are the three things I'm looking for.
Right.
And actually when candidates are getting sifted through from talent acquisition, a recruiter or HR, actually go, do they meet them three things? And if they do, that qualifies them for an interview. And then we can start then putting in the processes in place in order to actually make this a more successful hire for that hiring manager. And you know, that is the key steps that we're now taking with our clients to mitigate this friction with HR, talent acquisition, or like I said, the company policy, because it's culture, you know, it's free influence is there. You've got culture, you've got the leadership, and then you've got the actual opinions of people, which is the hardest thing to please because that can change on a daily basis.
Yeah. And yeah, that lines up. We've had a number of women in the industry on the show in the past, and you know, we got a very consistent, you know, answer and, you know, statistics and people, you know, agreeing with us that, you know, a lot of women or, you know, people of color, or you said neurodiverse people will avoid, you know, if they're not 100% qualified, they say, oh, I'm not going to do it. Whereas a lot of other folks will, if they're even 40% qualified, they're like, oh, close enough, you know, but I really like this idea of like cutting it down to three things you need, because I think it seems to me that a lot of the sort of issues we're having here is this sort of templatization of, you know, job descriptions, and also that, you know, like you said, that notion of like, it's like packing for a vacation, like you got to pack everything. It's like, all right, we're getting it all into this one little bag, you know, we're only going to be out of town for 2 days, you know, so figure it out. But, you know, is there a benefit, I think, to maybe just scrapping the sort of HR job template in the case of security and sort of custom writing these, you know, on a case by case basis? Does that, you think that'll sort of clear the clutter maybe?
Well, I mean, I don't understand how we don't do that. Like it should be per position, not as a standard. Sure. You know, I say that to candidates. Candidates should provide a resume that fits that job. And that means they've taken the time to do it. And organizations should take care. This is their external marketing. Right. This is how candidates perceive them in the market. And we are in a candidate-led market in cybersecurity. So we are all trying to find the A players in the market. That's what all organizations want. They want the best that is out there for the price they're willing to pay. And, you know, if you're going to market, you know, the wrong job description or just generic terms, you're not going to appeal to the market that you probably want, which is the market that everyone is going after. And if you want the best, you need to market it better. And there's certain organizations that do it very well. And there's certain organizations, especially large companies, that don't, because they just get generic HR people to often write their job descriptions. Mm-hmm. And the risk and security teams are often very busy people, as they have a day job to fulfill. Mm-hmm. And they will have a look at it and go, does it do what I basically need? Yes, let's sign off on it. And that's commonly what we see as that issue. And I totally get that, because CISOs are very overworked in terms of their jobs. Mm-hmm. Many security folks will say that they are. And they don't have the time to do recruiting. They don't have the time to do job descriptions. They have HR partners for that reason. And that then means you go out to a non-specialist and you go out there and they either try and search for people and often search wrong and waste time, or they come up with these generic job descriptions that don't market the company appropriately. Mm-hmm. And marketing and storytelling is the two biggest skills I think that companies need to realize when they are doing cybersecurity. And like I said, some companies are doing exceptional. Some companies have podcasts, you know, marketing tools, mm-hmm. they're holding events to try and lure candidates in. They've got really good internship programs. You know, they are trying to do as much as they can to build a talent pool or to increase their talent depth for when someone leaves. They now have a number of names that they can go to that they already know. And that is impressive. And that's talent strategy. That is talent marketing. That is where it needs to go. And if you're going to get ahead of the curve or the talent on war, as we call it here, but you have to get ahead of the curve, and it means being creative, and it means being a marketeer, and it means being a storyteller. And that's where, you know, leaders in cybersecurity need to convince their HR and talent acquisition to transition to in order to get ahead of the curve and actually decrease the time, which is what we all want. We want that pain to go away. Yeah. We need to decrease that fill time. And that's where we're focused on. And that's what we're focused on doing.
Yeah. I mean, you know, for as long as I can remember going back to college, like when they would say when writing a resume, you know, you said customize it to the job, but also like, you know, in the cover letter and in the resume, you need to tell the story of why you would be perfect for them and, you know, build the bridge to the employer. But we don't see a lot of that in the other direction where, you know, they're building the bridge to the person that they want. And I think what you're saying here makes a lot of sense in terms of like, it needs, you know, we both need to be on either side, need to be building the bridge to each other. Like you need to see why you could work here and why, you know, you're not having to swim across a moat, you know, filled with alligators and, you know, to even get to our front door.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I say to every candidate that interviews for us, you know, when I'm preparing them for their interview, I always say, look, you utilize this as a two-way interview. It has to be like that. You know, we're no longer in that bureaucratic society where it's a one-way interview. It has to be two ways. Mm-hmm. And organizations need to be aware of that they are interviewing and the person is interviewing them, because often we know that candidates will have 5-6 processes if they're actively looking. And even if they're not actively looking, they will guarantee have other options. They will at least have two or three other options. So you can sort of guarantee that in the recruitment market that you know you are fighting for that talent. So you need to be able to put the right solution in place. And that is from that job description. That job description is the first thing that people often see going into the process. So if you're talking about a talent identification and talent acquisition process, the first point of call is often that. The second point of call is often a talent acquisition person or a recruiter. Mm-hmm. So you have to screen them. You have to make sure that they are saying the right things. They are marketing the organization in the appropriate ways and able to answer the questions that the candidate might give them. Then it's all about the process from there, how they get into the process, who's interviewing, how well are they interviewing? Is that aligned with everyone else in the process? Are we all saying the same sort of vocabulary? And it's them little details that give you them marginal gains, an extra 1% that we're incredibly focused on here, that allows us and allows organizations to win. And that's all we care about, is our clients winning. That's all we care about. Sure. And it's them little 1% through that process. And as you said, it starts with that detailed but very concise and very specific job description.
There you go. So do you want to talk at all about the sort of, we talk about the skills half-life, you know, where there's so much where even if you're not, you know, doing an educational thing, you know, but you're just learning the industry, you know, so much information is, you know, worthless after 6 months or outdated or whatever. Do you feel that the speed of technological development is preventing potential cybersecurity pros from keeping up with these new innovations?
It depends on the individual. I honestly think that we are very fortunate in cybersecurity. People are aware of that. Mm-hmm. I think if you're not, you're in the wrong industry. Right. And I think if you don't want to learn, innovate, change, you are in the wrong industry. You can't stand still in cybersecurity. Like there is, you know, we can't stand still. If we stand still for a month or two, we no longer exist. In doing what we do, because our competitors take us over or we don't keep up with the latest trend. You know, there are certain growth areas such as incident response, application security, cloud security and product security that are, you know, them four areas are high growth. There's a lot of different areas going into them, you know, without going into the technology side of, you know, containers or the cloud providers, you know, like you can start going in and going very complex with that. And it is all about keeping ahead of the trend to make sure that you have a job in 5 to 10 years time. And that's where you've got to keep asking, what's your why? And where do you see yourself in 5 to 10 years time? Where do you see the market? And that's why I'm always saying, ask us what we're seeing in trends. Where do we see them going? Ask the CISO, what are they seeing? Like, you have to keep asking questions to make sure that you are maintaining with the trend, with the curve. Yes, okay, you want to keep ahead of the curve, but that is incredibly difficult to do unless you're in the know-how and got that exposure. Right. If you want to stay with the curve and make sure that you keep current and don't fall out of the employment circle, which can happen to many industries as it has done previously, you've got to keep learning and keep educating. And what's been great the last 2-3 years is seeing, you know, many of the providers like, you know, the InfoSec Institute, you know, and some of the other companies that are in the space actually providing education tools, the chance to actually use some of these technologies, whether it's on the forensic side or the real like tool side of, you know, the SIEM tools, etc., but actually getting that hands-on experience as well as not just, you know, that just, you know, listening to a speaker or what it could be. And I think that's where organizations are now looking, who's actually got hands-on experience that can actually bring that in and actually provide, you know, utilize that in-house. And them learning tools are allowing people to keep advanced and keep ahead of that to actually empower and enable some of the organization's problems.
Let's turn this around a little bit to the other side of the equation in terms of people looking for jobs. So, you know, we've hopefully removed some of the barriers to entry here. We've, you know, eliminated the educational requirements, and, you know, we've sort of pared it down to the things, you know, that the company really wants. So if you are someone who's just kind of getting started in the industry and want to, and maybe you don't have a lot of hands-on experience, or what are some of the things that you can do with your resume and your cover letter that will sort of make you stand out and come to the attention of the companies that you want to work for?
I think it's a really good question, and I've been asked that a lot by candidates, obviously with the current climate. And it sort of makes you think, because it's not just what we look at. We're trying to put ourselves in the shoes of the hiring manager and what they're looking for, and that's very different because it's the individual, and that's where it's slightly complex. But the generic things that we say is very much around keep it short, try and keep it to two pages. Or less.
Yes.
No one really cares about what you did 10 years ago, even 5 years ago. Everyone's about now on the present. As you just said, cybersecurity is ever changing. You won't have been doing the same technology. We won't be maybe using the same technology 10 years ago as you are now. Like it's adapted, it's changed. Yeah. So people care about the near and the present. That's the first thing. So keep, you know, your previous jobs very small. You know, you can keep the jobs in there. I think that's really important, so they don't think you've got gaps in there.
Or just highlight the one thing that you did 10 years ago that still relates to what you do now or whatever. Yeah.
Exactly right. Mm-hmm. Exactly right. And then achievements, numbers, and tools. So as we said, data is king these days. Oh, yeah. It provides evidence. So if you can show a 50% reduction in threats because of something you did, that's great.
I can and go keep and, those numbers on the job too, like while you're doing the job, you know, make sure if your boss says, you know, we've brought the number down, make a note somewhere, man.
Keep absolutely.
It. Yeah,
absolutely. And they are, you know, people can see that, people can feel that, you know, and that's what I'm talking about being a marketeer, being a storyteller. Like you have to be able to tell your own story. No one cares that you turned up to and worked 40 hours a week. People care about your actual, you know, achievement, your actual experience within that position. Yeah. And that's what's crucial. That's what people will look at. Okay. They've been a biggest retailer in the world, but what did they actually do? What did they actually achieve? Were they actually hands-on? Were they actually dealing with this tool? You know, were they using this SIEM tool, or, you know, were they part of the SOC or whatever it can be for that position? Mm-hmm. And that's really crucial. But the third part is the most critical, right? If I look at jobs on LinkedIn, and we can all do this, we can all go on LinkedIn, put in our favorite job, put in CISO. See how many applicants it's had. I guarantee it's had 300, 400 applicants, maybe more. Yep. Then they've probably got an internal team on that. They've got internal referrals. Yep. They've got external referrals. Then they've got recruiters working on it. So you're talking about 5-6 avenues. That's without going to job boards. That's without going to, you know, like random conversations or people that they've had previously. You know, there's so many different ways of getting to people, which is all the ways we use, by the way, as well. So if we're a recruiter, you know, you're talking about 10 to 20 to 30 to 40 different avenues by the time you start getting into recruiters for that organization to source from. And you expect your resume to get to the hiring manager on the desk and actually be seen and looked at.
Yeah.
The chance of that is, okay, it's not the same as what Richard Dawkins says about us being born, but it's a real hard chance. And I think
it's overwhelming to some people.
Absolutely. Like I'm sure you've gone, like if you go and look at a new job and you see 400 people have already gone for it on LinkedIn, I'm like, well, I'm not going to apply for that. Like,
like, I'm not the one,
you know? Yeah. Yeah. Like if my profile doesn't line up exactly, I'm not going to stand out. So what do I do? Well, I apply. And then I follow up and I keep following up till at least someone answers my call or someone answers my email. And I keep doing it. I keep trying to get referred in. I use a recruiter and I call the recruiter till they're fed up of me. I never ever, and by the way, other recruiters might be different, but I never ever get fed up by a candidate that keeps ringing my phone about an opportunity.
Yeah.
Like I want to understand, not that they're hungry or passionate, but I need to understand about their profile. I need to be able to tell their story. I can't tell it off a resume. Yeah. There's only certain amount of information that a resume can hold. You know, we if I see a 12-page, 15-page resume, I'm already bored by the first page.
Oh,
and that's no disrespect to the person, but I just, we get through so many resumes, so many applications, I don't have time. But if someone's got, you know, a 2-minute pitch to me about their candidacy for a position, I can either tell them that they're right for the role or they're wrong for the role, but at least I get an idea if they are right for the role from my perspective, and then I can present them to my client. And that is the key. Like it's all in the follow-up, and people forget this. People get so held up. You know, I don't even read cover letters anymore because it doesn't tell me enough. It just often cover letters tell me exactly what just told me in the job description.
Yep.
And the resume mm-hmm. and the resume tells me exactly what's on their LinkedIn quite often.
Mm-hmm.
So I could have just searched for them on LinkedIn and found that. Like, what are you telling me differently?
Okay.
You know, make me stand out and make me go sit up and go, okay, they're the ones I need to call back. Yeah. They're the ones I need to get in for an interview, you know, and that's the difference. It's okay. All in the follow-up and the resume is just not enough anymore.
Yeah. Now, that sort of brought up another thought that I just had, but like, you know, I think we've all had it before. We've applied to what we thought was a job we would have been 100% perfect for. Like, it absolutely lines up with our experience, and don't even get a call. Like, what are some, you know, I without being a nuisance or whatever, but like, what are your some suggestions for sort of like making your case, even when you think you're perfect and you're not, and they don't think you're perfect, or they didn't see you, or they got bored after 5 resumes or whatever. Do you have any other tips in that regard?
Yeah, it's incredibly complex because you don't know who else is involved in the process. So that's the key thing. I think always have more discussions. So talk to more people in the company than you need to if you're going direct. If you're going through the recruiter, ask them what will make you stand out as a candidate for this position. What has the hiring manager or the HR director said to them about what the key parts of this position? Mm-hmm. Ask them more questions, and that's where ask comes into it because it's such an important way. You know, if you're trying to go direct, get referred in. Get referred in by someone else in the team. Do you know someone? Security is a small market. You know, I know, you know, like on our database, we probably have anywhere between 6,000 to 10,000 people, which sounds a lot, but it's not once you really, you know the moving parts.
Like,
you
will probably all the way across the country. Yeah,
exactly. I will probably know at least one or two people in majority of the security operations across the United States. Mm-hmm. That's not because I'm good at my job. It's just because I get referred into different people. I go and ask people, and I go, oh, can you refer me into here? Or can you push into here? And over 2.5 years, I've been able to grow my network. And that's the key for people, especially like younger people, is network, network, network. Mm-hmm. Like, you have to keep doing it. It's tiring. It is tiring. Yeah. We don't all have the time to sit on LinkedIn and do it. That's part of my job. I have to sit on LinkedIn. It's where a lot of my job happens.
Yep.
It's where a lot of my conversations happen, as well as the phone. Mm-hmm. And that's my job. So I get to network as my job for 24, you know, we're feels 24/7 anyway, but it's a huge part of the job, and that's crucial. But it's the same for people that are looking for their next opportunity, or even not looking, to keep networking, because it's a way of learning. It's a way of, you know, having a better network. But if things do go wrong or you need to change, they are the first person you go to, like the recruiters, to go and get your next position. And I think, like, the power is in the question, the power is in the network, and the power is in the follow-up. And they're the three things that I can say is how you qualify if this is right for you. Because even if it looks good on paper, what the opinion of the hiring manager might be slightly different to what's wrote on the paper, because people's opinion change, and it can be a timing thing. You know, like, we have that with a couple of clients where they've gone, we've been searching for 3 weeks, and they've gone, actually, the CISO's changed his mind. Yeah. We're actually going to pull this post back in, and we're going to revisit it in the next week. We're going to have a lot of discussions about what he's actually looking for, because 10 candidates have been rejected that are perfect on the job description, but are not meeting his needs. So then we need to understand that. And we always push back on our clients going, this isn't working. We can't keep working like this. This isn't helping your reputation in the market, because you're mucking around candidates. But secondly, these candidates are going to be candidates that you're going to want in 2 to 5 years' time. If they have a bad experience now, they're not going to want to come back and work for this manager or this company again. And that's the pressure and the risk that you have when you market or get that opportunity wrong. And that's the hard thing for candidates, is trying to match the individual's opinions or expectations.
So obviously the past few months have probably completely changed the employment landscape yet again, with, you know, unemployment being what it is, and, you know, a lot of, you know, people's jobs being furloughed and people looking for new work. Can you talk a little bit about what the job market is right now in the age of COVID-19? Are there companies looking for candidates? And if so, like, where, who's hiring? Have, you know, the processes changed for being noticed or getting an interview, or is it all just, since it's all online anyway, is it pretty much the same?
It's an excellent question. It's so, firstly, it's such a strange time to be a part of, right? Like there's a lot of moving parts. There's a lot of things trying to understand it. And right. We work globally. So, you know, I'm very fortunate that I only focus on North America, but our company focuses globally. So we see different things in different areas. Sure. So if we're just talking about North America, and our main focus is US and Canada with that. So if we look at them two markets, it's slow. Every process is slow. Every candidate will tell you slow. Every hiring manager will tell you it's frustrating mm-hmm. right now to do what they want to do. And there's been a lot of cutback. You know, yep. we're seeing a lot of clients and a lot of companies that we deal with pull back and just go, let's wait. The market's a little bit unsteady. Let's mm-hmm. see what, you know, the president does. Let's see what the markets do and let's make yep. this plan from there. And that's, you know, as someone who understands business and runs the strategy here, I totally understand that. We've done exactly the same from a hiring process, you know, internally, like we've put things on hold and focused. However, the risk doesn't go away. And as what we've seen, the risk has accelerated from cyber threats or fraud attempts and you know, a lot of other threats, industry specific and state specific from that. So when you're looking at what has accelerated, what we're seeing is a lot of Fortune 500 companies that are big targets have kept up hiring or haven't let anyone go. They're the two strategies that we're often seeing because they're high targets. If you want a major bank, you go after the top 10 banks. Yeah. You know, you want your big payday. You want you want the exposure if you're a state entity.
Right.
Or you're a group that's trying to get attention. Mm-hmm. So they're still at risk and they're regulated from a breach response standpoint. And they're also, you know, they've also got a lot of shareholders to police. You know, they don't want to lose that money. So they have to make sure that risk and that PR crisis doesn't occur for them. The other areas are cash rich companies like Amazon, et cetera, that mm-hmm. are doing very well at the pandemic, that are seeing new areas that are, you know, coming out, new threats or new ways of working where they're having to adapt their security staff and risk staff and having to meet that need. And then the other area, which has been great, is, been really exciting to see, is critical infrastructure and governments, because they're right. having to keep running. Like they can't stop running and they can't let the guard down for any what reason. So the government entities, I live in Virginia, right near a lot of the government entities, mm-hmm. and we are seeing constant hiring, constant growth, you know, a lot of new roles being opened up. And that's exactly the same in the critical infrastructure space. And don't get me wrong, there's exceptions. There are exceptions in healthcare. Pharmaceuticals obviously are doing very well right now at this crisis. But they're the sort of three that we see quite often, is your Fortune 500, your cash rich companies, mm-hmm. and like I said, your real critical infrastructure entities that are seeing more exposure of risk and having to deal with it. And they're the ones that are really hiring right now and really accelerating in funding from that respect. And unfortunately, if we flip the coin, you're seeing retail furlough and get rid of entire security teams. You're seeing hospitality exactly the same. Your whole tourism market, you know, like the airlines and stuff like that has been hit. Yep. Oil and gas companies massively hit. So you've got the reverse. And that's where we're seeing a lot of good talent opening up for the other companies to take advantage of. And that's the message to our clients right now, is take advantage of this time while there's a lot of candidates, not necessarily at cheaper rates, but you're going to get them a lot easier and a lot quicker than you could have done previously.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about salary then. It's this common conception that cybersecurity is this high paying profession. And I mean, obviously it can be at the, you know, CISO level, but what are salaries like for people entering the profession, and what can you expect to move towards as you reach higher titles in the industry? And obviously, like you said, it's a little maybe depressed at the moment, but just so we can be realistic with people.
Yeah, and we're trying to analyze that. Like I said, we're incredibly data driven. So we provide, one of our services is salary benchmarking for our clients. So, you know, we constantly reach out to other companies and say, look, this is what we're currently seeing. And we don't really know what the fallout is from a salary basis. You know, we are hearing of companies potentially going to fire people, then rehire them on a lower salary, right. You know, which is obviously a fear of the market right now. And I would suggest in cyber that you don't need to do that. I think you can wait for that right opportunity, but your circumstance might not allow that. You might have to go back to work and earn money for your family. So that's a risk. And I think them organizations will be found out from a branding perspective. I think Mark Cuban has summed it up previously earlier in the pandemic, saying that brands, it's a make and break time for these brands that are not going to look after their people. And I think the cyber teams are going to find that as well. You know, don't look after your people and they won't stay, or they won't come back. And right. And that's what it's going to be. And they're going to tell their friends, and that's going to work out to the bigger market. So that's the first thing on salaries is I don't think people should go back to their previous jobs unless obviously, you know, circumstances say otherwise. But in terms of salary bandings, what we see for 2020 and going into 2021 as well, if people are starting to financially plan for that, sort of your entry roles are anywhere between your 50 to 90,000, depending on the skill set and depending on where they sit. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is how big the organization is, right. Your exposure, and whether you've got any sort of previous experience as well. Once you start going a sort of 2 to 5 years of experience, you start looking between the 90 to 130 banding. What we class as sort of an analyst, a consultant, or associate banding. That's how we class it. And years of experience is so opinionated again, because you can come from an IT background of 10 to 15 years. There's not one path. And I love talking about career paths all day in cyber, because yeah. I love it. It's fascinating. Like,
it is fascinating.
When you get into sport, you go into an academy, you go straight the way up, you go into the first team.
Yep.
That's it. Like, there is normally one route in, unless you get some exceptions.
Yeah.
But them exceptions are anomalies. In cyber, when we've done a lot of pointing, like we go, okay, there's a dot there, there's a dot there, there's a dot there, there's a dot there. There's not one path. Like, right. There's so many ways in. So when we say years of experience, it's years in the workplace.
Okay.
And years of experience of
not necessarily, you know, 5 years being a threat responder, but 5 years in being something of security. Yeah.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Because that is just as important. That is mm-hmm. just as important, because you can navigate that, and you can tell a story about how that yes. relates to that job and how that relates.
Right.
And that's where storytelling comes in.
There you go.
A manager is often we see that banding around. People have normally got 4 to 8 years of experience, normally sitting in a manager sort of position. A manager can be a sort of SME type or a manager of a team. So it could be like a SOC manager, it could be an IR manager, whatever it could be. And often that job title is anywhere between 120 to 200. And the reason, because of that gap, and that's quite a large gap, and, you know, we're going to talk about the CISO position in a minute, where the gap becomes huge.
Yeah.
But the reason because of that is because every organization values it differently. Some yes. cyber managers would be a cyber director in a larger firm.
There you go.
Like, it's mm-hmm. just that they could be a deputy CISO in that respect. So they could have more responsibility than a manager who's just overseeing a small team of threat intelligence people. So it depends on the responsibility, depends on the size of organization, and it depends on the location. And the last thing it depends on is whether you're regulated or not. And I can touch base on a little bit of that in terms of how that's now working out in the industries.
Okay. And
the next one is director. So what we call director, it can be, obviously director can be broken into sort of your VPs, your SVPs, your SMDs, mm-hmm. you know, your different titles that the banks love and the insurance companies love to throw in now. And it seems like healthcare and pharmaceuticals are now following suit with that.
Yep. Yep.
But you're sort of looking to 7 to 12 years, maybe a little bit more, depending on the appetite of the person and whether the pathway to the next step up is there. And that's anywhere between 150 to 250, we're often seeing.
Okay.
So again, a bigger gap. And as you go up the pyramid, it gets a bigger gap, but then jobs become less and less.
Of course.
You know, they start filtering out once you get, obviously, as you know, to the CISO position, where there isn't yeah. that many positions and you're fighting out with hundreds of other people for them.
And it might only be in certain parts of the country too. Like you say, there might not be a ton of CISO positions, you know, in some place that doesn't have a huge tech center.
Yeah, absolutely. And we do that a lot for our clients. We will go and we can talk about talent strategies and how we find them for clients if you like. But like, we start off local for our clients, and then we start mapping it out because, you know, like we know that there's not always the best talent in a certain aspect of Kentucky. You might have to have someone who's remote or might have to pay a lot more to relocate them because of that talent's not there. And I'm not picking on Kentucky as such. No, that's just an example. Yeah. But when you start getting into their more rural areas or, like you say, less tech hubs, you start having to fight with other companies that are all fighting for the same talent. And what a certain organization, there's a big financial services firm here in Virginia who just started to try and pay premiums on people to get them away from other companies. That has a very short-term effect. We know money only drives people for a certain amount of time. That's human psychology. Maslow's hierarchy of needs, if you believe that, you know, suggests that. But once you start thinking about, okay, what's the wider picture of this? Okay, here's your salary band, but this is the other benefits. We're going to provide you with an education. We're going to provide you with access to this, access to that. Here's your 401k for, you know, to provide your future. Here's your healthcare. We're going to provide you with a healthcare for your family. You start providing bigger benefits. You don't have to pay as much as just trying to compete. And at the end of the day, cybersecurity, unless you're a consultancy or a vendor, is a cost center. And we have to be more critical in terms of what we're paying. And that's where our clients tend to come to us and go, am I paying appropriately to get the right level of talent that I want? And that's where you can push back on your job descriptions and your talent searches and talent pools. And often people don't like that, especially candidates, because I can take jobs out of New York and put them in Dallas a lot cheaper. But also the talent could be better there. And that's where companies have to be awake to that, is like, okay, I can go to Kentucky and pay $50,000 less maybe than San Francisco or New York. But is that actually realistic? Is the talent there? And then you've got to start looking at, okay, how long am I going to be able to keep this talent? How long, what have I got to invest in this talent to keep them there? What about relocation fees? Does it actually make sense for me to put that position there? And that's where it becomes a whole data play from a talent strategy perspective, in terms of is that worth putting there. So it's a little bit more than just when we say salary bands. For a candidate, this is great, but for a client, there's a lot more external and internal factors that they have to consider as to whether they're going to base this position here or whether they're going to pay that salary banding. And that sort of brings me on to the last point, CISOs. CISOs are great for this because it does depend on the size company, does depend on whether you're regulated, and it does depend on the risk factors that we tend to see for that organization, i.e. are they, you know, what is their reporting line? Are they having to report to the board because the risks are, because they value security so highly, because the risks are so high? That's going to push your salary banding up a lot more towards the C-suite level. If you're two or three down, which still blows my mind, but still happens, and I'm sure a lot of CISOs listening to this, it hurts them, because I'm having to now be a career coach for CISOs to try and help them improve their reporting line, which I never imagined doing, by the way. But there's some CISOs that I speak to are at 150, 180. I'm like, you are overseeing a security program. Firstly, how are you hiring people that are below your salary? Secondly, how can you convince me as a candidate that they're taking security seriously when you're not being paid well enough? You're not being valued at your job. And that's the key thing. And what I'm now trying to convince CISOs is to try and be, okay, you've exhausted all options. You've led with data. You've gone to that board and said, I'm going to leave, or I want to do this, and this is where the market values me. Whatever you need to do to get that conversation going. And we provide a lot of suggestions on that.
So I just have kind of one or two more questions for you in here anyway, but apart from, you know, like I say, I'm sure we do have CISOs listening, but what we get a lot of is people who are just not only at the bottom rung of the, you know, the security ladder, but who are just thinking about even just entering the industry. So as someone who helps cybersecurity professionals at all levels, do you have any tips for newcomers who might feel a little intimidated about how to start their job searches, or what of their skills to sort of emphasize and their resume?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think it's obviously a focus point with the myth of the skills gap. You know, our key message is that we don't really believe there's a skills gap. We just believe that people need to change their behaviors and beliefs in terms of what that looks like and how that works. And we've touched on job descriptions, we touched on salaries. They're key things that create the skills gap. But the second thing is the amount of young people we're now producing for cybersecurity. And our fear, and the fear that we're
fear is the wrong word, but our sort of exposure to the market mm-hmm. allows us to see into the job, you know, the job economy as such. And what we, you know, and I'm very fortunate to deal with some of the best universities in the United States and actually, you know, talk to them about this. And I'm trying to teach some of the professors, like saying, like, we are creating fascinating, exciting degrees that are very cyber, you know, specific. We're developing security architecture and engineering specific degrees. We are teaching more assurance degrees now, more instant response and digital forensic degrees. You know, there's a couple of brilliant digital forensic degrees that we are able to recruit for our consultancies directly from them universities. However, when we talk about the pyramid with the CISO at the top,
right.
what we've currently seen is there's a pyramid at the bottom. So it's become a diamond.
Interesting.
Entry level jobs are very, very small right now.
Yeah.
And we've turned this industry into a lot of mid-level people that are finding it hard to get up. And we found that there's a lot of entry level people that just can't enter the diamond.
Right. And a lot of people feel that, I think. Yeah.
Absolutely. And we can't hide that. That exists. That exists. And what we're trying to communicate is that the market we now need to start considering isn't an entry level market for people that are coming into the industry because of trust. You know, do you trust a graduate to come in and take on an exposure of risk?
Right.
Do we actually want that? Like, we all seem to put on job descriptions. Obviously I don't design the job descriptions, but what we see is, yeah. you know, minimum 2 years experience. So do we just not want that? And the third thing is, are we able to get them internships or any type of experience to, you know, get them on the road and get them some real life experience? Because we always hear that famous term, well, what real life experience do you have?
Yes.
Well, if you don't give the people the opportunity, you can't. They can't get the real life experience. We all know that. We've all had that for the last 20 to 30 years. It was exactly the same when I came out of university as it would be to anyone else's generation that came out of university. So, you know, and that comes back to our, you know, why don't we just abolish degrees as a need? Because, you know, them people that don't have the degrees have normally got the real life experience, and that's where we're that sort of half a dozen of one, you know, half a dozen of another, you know, it's that catch 22 scenario. So what we need to make candidates aware is that we need them to go and get IT experience or risk experience. Look at different areas where you can touch cyber. You might go into an incident management, role or a IT help desk role or a IT support role or a risk analyst, something that they don't see something they see as an avenue into cybersecurity, and there's some of the areas, and that can get you a real life 1 year, 2 year experience, and they will allow you to work on tools like Burp Suite or FTK right. and forensics or whatever it is.
There you go.
And that's the way of learning, and that's the way of getting that experience. In terms of internships, there's some great ones out there. Unfortunately, you know, companies still don't value this as real life experience.
Okay.
And that's the thing that we get. I go, well, they've just been at Aon and completed a 3 month internship.
Yeah.
You know, or been at Walmart or been at Facebook or Google and some of these large organizations that provide excellent internships. And I've witnessed a lot of them. I've been inside them to be able to tell my clients, this is what's going on. But many of them don't value that because of a company policy, a bit like the degree, that value that as real life experience. Now, I still say go and get that experience because the network that you get from them experiences is by far more valuable than what you actually might learn on them experiences. But be open if you're entering this market. Be open to cyber jobs, be open to IT jobs, be open to risk jobs, and certainly don't take the first no, because you're going to get a lot of no's in your career that if you stop now, you're never going to be successful in cybersecurity.
Okay, so as we wrap up today, I want to talk a little bit about Beecher Madden, and so I want to get a sense of what types of services do you provide for your clients, and what sort of people who might be listening to this might want to use you, you know, and so forth.
Yeah, we have the traditional recruitment services, So we do permanent and contracting within the cybersecurity and risk sector for a number of organizations. You know, we have well over 100 clients that just in the US alone that we're very fortunate to work for. And so from a candidate perspective, you know, the to provide a better education, the organization is the one that pays us. They contract us to find these people for them. Yep. So the candidates are always willing to approach us, you know, and see what opportunities we have. And on the client side, you know, we provide that model as well as executive search for CISOs, CIOs, and similar positions. And then away from that, for the client perspective, as I was going to say, is around data analytics. So we provide a lot of talent pools. We can tell you where best to provide, where best to put that skill set. We do skills audits for our clients. We do a lot of consultancy where we would go on site for a number of days for our clients to actually work out like, okay, what do they need? How Yep. better can we improve their processes? How better can we actually make them more attractive for candidates to hopefully decrease that fill time and actually decrease their risk, because people are risk and recruitment is a risk to the business. So we help them better understand that and better help CISOs educate HR and talent acquisition on that as well, because obviously there's a lot of generalists that don't understand what they're looking for or how to best to speak to the market as well. And the last bit is salary benchmarking. You know, that's where we're probably really utilized in the marketplace right now is we do a lot of salary benchmarking for our clients, and we do that globally, which allows CISOs to go to their board and say, this is how much it's going to cost. I think I can get this person for this. Can I get sign off to go and do that? And we can do that a lot quicker. You know, evidence-based is exactly how CISOs and heads of security are going to win in this market. And keep a ahead of their competition, but also keep their board happy, which is ultimately the CISO should be their CISO's goal, is to keep the C-suite and board happy, because that makes them have an easier and stress-free in somewhat life, I suppose, in somewhat way. I don't know how when so many CISOs are telling me they're burning out, but I think keeping them off their back is hopefully will make their job easier.
So if our listeners want to know more about Carl Sharman or Beecher Madden, where can they go online?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. We have BeecherMadden.com, and you can find me.
B-E-E-C-H-E-R Madden.
M-A-D-D-E-N. Yeah. Yep. .com.
Okay.
And not short at all. Ultimately find me on my LinkedIn, reach out. I'm always willing to have conversations with people.
Great.
Most people find my number. Most people find my email very easily as well. That's the problem with media these days, especially when I leave it on my LinkedIn half the time as well.
Yeah.
Obviously, like I'm absolutely happy to have conversations with anyone and see how I can benefit their career or benefit the issues they're having in their organization from a staffing perspective. Happy to keep educating and keep learning myself as well.
That's awesome, Carl. Thank you so much for your time and insights today. I really appreciate your time.
No, I appreciate yours, and it was great being a part of this.
Good. Well, we're happy to have you, and we'd like to thank you all, as usual, for listening and watching. If you enjoyed today's video, you can find many more of them on our YouTube page. Just go to youtube.com and type in CyberWork with InfoSec to check out our collection of tutorials, interviews, and past webinars. If you'd rather have us in your ears during your workday, all of our videos are also available as audio podcasts. Just search CyberWork with InfoSec in your podcast catcher of choice. And if you wouldn't mind, leave us a 5-star rating and review. It really does help people to find us. For a free month of the InfoSec skills platform discussed in today's show, just go to infosec.com/skills, sign up for an account, and in the coupon line, type CyberWork, all one word, all small letters, no spaces, to get your free month. You can also use our free election security training resource to educate poll workers and volunteers on the cybersecurity threats they might face during the election season. For more information about how to download your training packet, visit infosecinstitute.com/IQ/election-security-training or click the link in the description. Thank you once again to Carl Sharman and Beecher Madden, and thank you all for watching and listening. We will speak to you next week.